Hey there, everyone. I hope we're all having a great day today. Before we get started with this week's episode, I do have a quick announcement. If you want to skip forward a few minutes, go for it. I'm going to try to make this quick. But I did mention last week that there would be an announcement. Anyway, so the first announcement actually is I know that this episode is a little bit late. There was a freak power outage at my job last week, and I was unable to record. When I say a freak power outage, I mean legitimately the lights and everything went off for about 3 seconds. The backup generators came on, and then the power came back on because you heard the coffee machine go again, you heard the cooler start running, the rest of the lights came on, and just a few sounds were made by some appliances in the area. But because this happened on a Saturday, or because this happened on a Friday, I mean, because we work on Saturdays and Sundays, the power was off for the entire weekend. And because there was no IT people around in the building to help out with it, we still had to come into work on Saturday, but we pretty much got paid just to kind of sit around. And my boss and I were just working on our side grinds. I was writing a few more details for this week's episode, and he was working on his teaching. But yeah, so it was pretty cool. We got to just kind of chill for an entire day, get paid to just work on our side grinds. So there's that. So it's up now, and here's the episode. And then the second announcement that I actually wanted to make is that this episode is a double feature. I had a lot of fun writing this these two episodes out. It was really fun because I didn't really need to go too in-depth with the story. I didn't really need to write too many details in there. And it was just a nice, scary story where you're left still kind of wondering certain things. Granted, I don't leave too many loose ends, but there is that curiosity factor in there. So please let me know on Instagram if you would like to see more of these episodes or hear more of these episodes. I had a lot of fun writing them, so I can honestly see myself writing more of these in the future. But still, let me know how you liked it and what you would like to see more of in these double features or what can be improved. Just let me know, and I'd love to implement it into season two. So now let's just go ahead and get started with our episodes today. Good morning, everyone. I hope we're having a great day today. So today I have a two-part for you. I have Mark and Greg here. And they're brothers who live on opposite sides of where we, but they both listen to the podcast, and they said that they have creepy experiences that they've come across, but they don't feel like it's necessarily as long as a normal podcast episode. So they both decided to come on in and share their experiences with us. So without delaying no further, let's get into this week's episode. And I guess I'll go first. First off, I live in Wyoming. The reason why I bring this up is because it's important to know that there aren't really many things in Wyoming. There are miles away from the closest anything, and we got a lot of snow. And another reason why I bring this up is because my mother's birthday is in winter. And once a year, the family will drive or take planes in to visit my mom. And in my case, I actually drive there. It's about an 8-hour drive, and to put that into perspective, it's about 480 miles, give or take. But the thing is that because it is snowing, the drive there and back is scheduled to be a little bit longer than 8 hours with all the black ice and the snow or hail, or if it's snowing at the time. And this road that I take, it's a road that if you're an outsider of this area of Werri, then it's going to take an 8-hour drive. But for the most part, the people that live there, they're close to everything, but just the drive there is just an excruciating 8 hours. Now, as you're making the drive on over, you still have a while until you hit freeway 555. And so as you're driving, before you're about to hit the final gas station, you'll actually see this giant billboard of a sign, and you can't miss it. It's red and yellow, and it reads, "Don't forget to fill your gas tank or get extra fuel." And the reason for this is because as you're driving, at some point you're going to hit a 100 mile stretch of land that just, there's nothing there. It's an absolute dead zone. There's no gas stations, there's no houses, there's no huts, there's no anything really on there. It's just one side is forest and the other side is forest as well. So there's really nothing out there. At some point, even landline poles and I don't know what they're called, but electric poles that have Wi-Fi and internet and service and all that stuff, they're pretty much non-existent in this area, in this dead zone. Now, I know that 100 miles doesn't sound too bad. It's around 1 hour and 40 minutes, depending on how fast you drive. But remember, it is snowing, and the speed limit already, because there's so much terrain, and you have to worry about deer and wildlife kind of coming out from the trees, this drive, the speed limit is actually 45 miles an hour, even though it's pretty much like a highway. It just goes straight down. There are some curves and turns from time to time, the occasional hill, but it's just a straight road, essentially, with forest on each side. But because it is also snowing, means that we have to go even slower. So I'm honestly going about 40, and that's probably going really fast in terms of there may be black ice. So you really need to go around 30 to 25. It sucks, but it's to be expected. As I was driving down the road, I ran out of gas, but as I already said, it's to be expected. I always make sure that I have an extra tank of gas in the trunk of my car whenever I make this trip. So I just got out of the car, went to my trunk, and grabbed the extra tank of gas. As I was refilling my car, I was just looking around, taking in the sights. There were a lot of birch trees around, and they were just littered with snow. There was snow all over the place. It's a really beautiful sight, though. The air was crisp, and when you took a deep breath, you were able to feel your lungs just expand and the real coldness of the air. You look around, and all the leaves are changing colors and falling to the ground. There aren't that many animals around, but you'll hear the occasional bird chirping and stuff of that matter. But once I was done, I got back in my car, and I was only 20 miles away from the nearest gas station, so I just went for it. This gas station was more of a trucker stop. If you don't know what a trucker stop is pretty much for a gas station, like a super gas station that's meant for people who are on the road for long periods of time. So people who are traveling cross country, or well, truckers will usually stop there. You can get your truck, and I'm talking like semi-trucks, 18-wheelers, stuff like that. You can get them washed, you can get them detailed. There's accessories you could buy for them. There's a gift shop in there, as well as places that you can park at overnight and just stay overnight, sleep there, recuperate, do what you need to do. There's a bunch of ready meals where you just put some water in a bowl or in a bag and shake it up a little bit, put it in the microwave, and you got yourself a warm meal. And on top of it, there's this really nice diner there as well. Now, it's almost like tradition for me to stop at the diner every time I am there. I will refill on gas and grab a backup canister, and I will eat at the diner. I know it sounds a little weird eating at a diner that is located at a trucker stop. Usually when you order anything with meat, it comes out with gray, or whenever you order mashed potatoes, odds are it came from a box. Same thing with soup, probably came from a can, but this diner was actually really good. The food there, I don't care where it came from, it probably came from a can, but it was just so hearty and wholesome, and even if it came from a can, it was probably the best canned food I've ever had. So I always make it a tradition to stop there for a quick meal and to refill on my gas and get extra gas as well. So that was the same plan today. Once I parked, I went inside to go fill up my tank of gas, but I heard somebody call my name. "Hey, Mark, how you doing?" I looked around and saw it was my uncle. "Anthony, how you doing?" I walked up and gave him a hug. "Hey, we're good, yeah, Ann and I just flew in. It was a really nice flight. It was about a 3-hour flight. Your aunt got a little bit of jet lag, or whatever they call it, where she got all sleepy, but the random turbulence woke her up." "Oh, really? Yeah, it'll do that, I bet. But what are you doing here?" I just drove in from the other side of town. It was an 8-hour drive." "Oh, wow, really? Yeah, so I'm just gonna refill on some gas and get something to eat." "Oh, really? What is there to eat around here? I am a little hungry." You know what? As weird as it sounds, the diner here is actually really good." "Oh, no kidding." "Yeah, it's actually pretty good. I know it sounds a little weird, but, you know what? Let me just buy you lunch, and I'll prove it to you, okay?" "All right, I'm not gonna get sick or anything, am I?" No, trust me, you're not. It's actually really good." We exchanged a laugh. I filled up the tank to my car, and we had lunch at the diner. And shortly after that, we just went to my mom's. I'm gonna spare you all the details of what happened at my mom's house, just because nothing really interesting happened there. Just pretty much a family reunion, if you will. I mean, unless you want to hear about my sister Tina, who ate a bad deviled egg and, well, hogged up the toilet for the rest of the day. But I'm gonna spare you those details. After about 2 days, I left. Usually at mom's house, people are welcome to go whenever they want. Sometimes you have family who is there for a day and leaves, or there for a few hours, leaves, a few days, leave. In my case, I was only there for the weekend, so I was only there for 2 days, and I left to go home. On my drive home, I was about 43 miles into this 80-mile drive, and I run out of gas. I got out of my car and opened my trunk up to grab the gas. I grabbed the canister and my stomach sank and my heart skipped, as it was pretty weightless. Now, it's not necessarily heavy, but there is some weight associated with it, and for a moment I was in denial. No, I didn't forget. I opened up the canister, hoping to smell the gas, which I did. I shook it to try to feel some weight shifting as well as some liquids moving, and didn't hear it nor see it. And then I remember. I got distracted by seeing my Uncle Anthony, and I forgot to fill up my extra gas tank. I filled up my car, but the amount of gas I had in my car was nowhere close to what I needed for this drive. So I just got back in my car. Now, there's nothing more I can do at this point. I had to sit and wait. There were no landlines, and that didn't deter me from checking my phone to make sure that there was service, which there was not. But the good news is that a lot of trucks go down this road. Not as many cars, but more trucks. And with it being a two-lane road, I could imagine it's very easy for people to see that I am in need, especially when I'm parked in the middle of one of the roads. So I just had to wait at this point. A few hours passed, and the sun was starting to go down, and there were still no trucks. I thought about walking it, but again, I was 43 miles into this 80-mile drive. No matter where I walked to, even if I was able to walk somewhere, the snow and the temperature outside was enough for snowfall. And I was somewhat exposed to the elements. I had a wool beanie on, a flannel, and a jean jacket. I had jeans and boots on with wool socks. I was pretty exposed out there, and even though the clothing I had is warm, when you're exposed to freezing temperatures, you're gonna get cold pretty fast. I was just waiting there, and eventually I even fell asleep and took a nap. I mean, what else am I gonna do there? If somebody drives by, it's not like I'm gonna have to wave them down. They're probably just gonna walk up to my car. But when I woke up to the sounds of something outside. I looked around and it was dark. Now, I couldn't tell you what that was, but as soon as I heard it, my heart sank. It was really dark outside, and I didn't even know if I wanted to look out the window once I heard that. I don't know what that was, but I just put my chair all the way back instinctually. Whatever that was, I didn't want it knowing that I was in here. At some point, it started even moving my car around. I felt my car just shaking and moving. I'm not sure what that was, but I just stayed still. I don't know if I was frozen in fear or something told me to just be quiet, but I didn't want whatever the thing out there is to know that I was in here. Eventually, it just went away. I didn't get up from my position, though. I stayed laying down. I knew that if somebody were to drive by again, I wouldn't have to wave them down. So I just stayed laying back in my seat. I just drive a pickup truck. It's not that high off the ground. It's not like I'm driving a tank or anything like that. If something really wanted to get in here, I don't think it would be hard for it to get in here. Sure enough, it came back again. But this time it wasn't around. Out there mimicking other sounds? Was that a human sound that it just made? Can it mimic humans? I just laid there, motionless and scared. Whatever it was, they were still trying to get in, and they still kept mimicking sounds. I didn't know what was going on, and I didn't even know what that was, but I feel like they were trying to get me to get out of the car, based on all the different sounds they were making. It was just clawing at the sides of my car all over. It wouldn't stop. suddenly, in my rearview mirror, I saw lights approaching, and the animals scurried off as if the lights scared them. I stayed in my car, but at the same time, I wanted to let them know that I was in here, so I held my hands up and just waved them, hoping that they would be able to see me from my rearview window. Sure enough, the car parked next to me, and I heard somebody get out. I peeked over to make sure it was an actual person, and it was. I quickly got out of my car. Please, I need your help, I said. Oh, what happened to your car? Your car's all scratched up. I know. I know it sounds crazy. I just need to go back to town. Please help me. Okay, get on in. I thanked him and got in my car, and we drove off. As we were driving off, I was just staring at my car in the rear view, and I saw two Sasquatch-looking things just walk out from the woods. I don't know what they were, but when I eventually came back to get my car, I saw that the doors were pried open, the windows were destroyed, and even the tires were destroyed. Just thinking that if that man didn't drive along and pick me up, I probably would have been dead.
Wow, what an interesting story, Mark. You know, I think I've heard of those things that came out. They're sort of a Weretown local legend of, I think, saber yetis. Not much is known about them. They're, well, almost like Bigfoot, but that's crazy, huh? Well, thank you for sharing, Mark. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have Craig up here to tell his story. First, let's hear a word from our sponsors.
Hi, yeah. So my name is Craig, and I work at Wareys University. I teach anatomy as well as anthropology. Technically, my title is Dr. Craig, as I am actually a doctor who part-time works at Wareys Historical Museum. If you've never been to Wareys Historical Museum, I would go. I would, without tooting my own horn, it's kind of like the British Museum, where we get a lot of different and interesting pieces that come on in from around the world. And it's just, it's really lovely to just work there. I do work in the Mummy Museum. And 2 weeks ago, we just got Lucy, the first bipedal human to kind of go on land from the trees. So it was really nice having her in our displays. Just the history is just so rich with her. But so this takes place a few months ago. I got a call at 9:10 p.m. And it was from the museum. They told me pretty much that a construction crew at 7:35 was pretty much digging up the ground to build a playground. And as they were digging up the ground, they came across a coffin. Nobody really touched it. They called the authorities. The authorities called us pretty much to come on in and take care of it. So we got it transported to the museum, or the museum had it transported to the museum, and then they called us in to me and my colleagues to come on in and investigate it. So I showed up at 9:42, and me and the other four of my colleagues had a four-hour night. In that night, I went ahead and canceled my classes for the next morning, and I was planning on the next morning to go ahead and call in a substitute to take care of my classes. But we were there, and it was a really primitive looking coffin. We were actually really excited. So the 4 hours we were there, we were just doing some tests. We were getting soil samples from the coffin, gonna figure out the age of that and figure out the soil of the area. We took off small pieces of just loose wood that was going to come off anyway, and we sent that for analysis to see what year it was dated back to. And we also just cleaned up the coffin a bit, ran some scans, CAT scans, as well as scans to see what is inside the coffin. Is it CO2, O2, what is it? We want to make sure that when we do open the coffin, if we're able to, that we don't damage the mummy inside or any of the valuables. Usually mummies will have valuables buried with them. So we ran those tests and we called it a night, since it would take a few hours for us to get the results back. Morning came, and me and my colleagues showed up to the lab, and there was waiting for us was the coffin and the test results as well. So some of the scans showed that there was a mummy inside, and that the that pretty much we had the green light to open it up. We also got tests back that found old writing on it. We didn't see this initially with the coffin, because it appears that the words on the coffin were etched in there, carved in there, and then because of all the dirt that was just piled on top of the coffin for so long, that it just kind of stuck there. Even after we were done cleaning it up, there was still dirt that was just engraved in the lettering. But because of the scans, we were able to not only see that there were wording there, but we were able to see that there was actually quite a bit on the coffin. It took up a good foot of the coffin in just wording. Now, it's interesting because we looked at this, at the language, and the only thing we were able to recognize from it was that it was a very old and very outdated form of tribal language. Not necessarily Native American, but it was definitely tribal, and we don't really know the origins of it. If I were to describe this language, it's like Latin. Latin was a language that eventually branched off into different languages. There's some similarities here and there, but for the most part, they are different languages, and that's what this writing was. It was an old tribal language that was amazingly outdated, but it was one of the first languages of its kind. We looked over the words and we couldn't really figure out anything from the first initial glance, but the thing that did pop up was the word Gova. Gova means king. And so we just called this mummy the Gova mummy, or the king mummy. But one of my colleagues, Dr. Scott, is an expert in ancient languages. So he had a field day with this. He just went ahead and took the scanned paper that had the writing on it, and just went to his room in the office for a few hours. Now, since we got the green light to open up this coffin, I let my colleague, Dr. Amy, actually open it up. So we had the mummy on this table, and we took a scalpel and just very carefully, and we took our time, but we just traced the lid of the coffin. We didn't want to do any damage to the coffin or the mummy inside or any of the artifacts, so we really took our time with this process. But as soon as we saw that the scalpel went all the way through, we knew that, okay, the coffin's open now. So we took our time and we just gently lifted the lid of the coffin and moved it over. We didn't do too much with it, we just kind of placed it on the side. Obviously, you get that aroma, if you will, from a mummy, but again, we had the proper equipment and the proper tools necessary to pretty much battle this smell. But our first initial sight of the mummy was this half-decomposed mummy. It had a lock of braided hair on over to the left of it, an armband on its right tricep and bicep. Its arms were bound, its jaw was wide open as if they died in pain, and there was a cut underneath the left nipple. This mummy was in fact a male, and thanks to the many scans that we did, we were able to determine their last meal. Their last meal was more on the higher end at the time, if you can say that. It ate a porridge that was made out of corn and potato, as well as ate some homemade bread made out of oil, wheat, and some other ingredients. But it was just really interesting that I had this meal because, like I said, only royalty really ate like this. They had access to not only the culinary skill, but also the tools in order to go ahead and make bread and stews of this kind. Now, during these scans, we also found that the mummy is, missing a few organs. They were missing the kidney, the liver, and the spleen. The weird thing is that not all the organs were taken. The heart wasn't taken, the stomach wasn't taken. The what constituted very vital organs at the time were not really taken. I mean, some of them were with the liver, but aside from that, the other organs were still intact. So that was a little weird to us at first. But we just continued to look over the mummy and its body and its remains. Now, it was clear to see that just the overall look of the mummy, that this was a murder. This was definitely a murder. But the fact that they cut below the nipple was weird. And then the lock of hair was weird as well. But we studied the armband and found that it did come from a tribe that has very little documentation about themselves. We know that they were a tribe of warriors who took part in psychedelics. When I say psychedelics, I mean like mushrooms, coca leaves, and even fishing for pufferfish, pufferfish were a lot more common in the area, or at least relatives of pufferfish, and they would take them and they would actually take the poison inside of a dead pufferfish, and then just kind of, they would, over a long extensive process, they would turn that poison into a powder, and then they would actually smoke it and just be on hallucinogens pretty much. There wasn't really much known about this tribe besides the fact that they did use unorthodox weapons like stone axes. They did use stingray barbs on a spear, as well as plenty of different type of very primitive weapons. Even for the time, it was seen as somewhat primitive. Not a lot is really known about this tribe too, just because the documentation of their specific tribe wasn't really kept up as well. So we know a little bit about the tribe that they came from, not as much as we would like to though. So we had to do some more digging, if you will. The overall amount of time it took us to do research on this mummy was around 14 days. Although I remember that my colleague Dr. Murphy pointed something very interesting to us out. Dr. Murphy, she was doing a lot of research on the wood in the for the coffin. And it dated back to the 800s, and So we were just blown away by that fact alone, but then she found something more grim with it. None of us really bothered to check the bottom part of the lid of the coffin, but when Dr. Murphy did, she found numerous scratch marks and blood stains. And we went back to look at the King Mummy, and we paid extra attention to the fingers, because usually over time the fingertips will erode on a mummy. They're very sensitive areas, and so usually decomposition is very likely to happen in the fingers. But when we noted this, that there are scratch marks on the bottom of the coffin lid, we went back and looked at the fingers again. And then we saw that the bones in the fingertips had been broken. There were extensive mutilations to the fingertips, and the nails were coming off. We thought it was decomposition, but whoever was in here was scratching their way out, or at least trying to scratch their way out. And then it came over us, the even more grim, if you will, part of it. This mummy was missing the kidney, livers, and the spleen. That means that while this person was clawing at this coffin, at the same time, they just got done with the surgery, removing very vital organs. Even if this person was able to scratch through the coffin, where would they go? How long would they survive? We took a moment of silence, as with the ancient world, you come across a lot of sacrifices. But usually they're not really as brutal as this. I mean, yeah, you have the fractured skull from time to time, but it's usually just a quick thing. This one, however, though, was long and drawn out. And then that's when Dr. Scott got back to us. He translated what was written at the top of the coffin. The whistle's up and played, and the king is fed. He will live forever in the world over the great horizon. This is a noble and just king, whose life is for the queen of shadow and death. He is offered to her, as his land is rich and his people are fed. For many moons he has given his people great leadership with his wife the goddess. Now is the time for renewal. She has called her king to the great astral afterlife. His presence is mighty to offer such a great gift to our queen. After that, you go down a little bit, and then there's more writing. Let no man or woman disturb this grave, or let their death be swift. Choked like birds they will be if our king or her husband, the king, is disturbed. Usually whenever you deal with mummies, you come across curses all the time. Curse of death, a curse of illness, curse of sickness, death of family member, yada yada yada. But this one was different. Once Dr. Scott told us what it said, we all felt a chill. We did some more research and found that the tribe is called the Anosi Govasa tribe. They were a tribe located near the wetlands of Werewetown. They were a more hostile tribe, and they were known for their religion of bloodshed. They believed that death was different than how you and me would see death. They saw it as a victory. They saw it as something that was sacred. But the thing is, they didn't last that long. every time there was a king that was great at running the kingdom, they would always sacrifice the king for this mysterious goddess of death. So they didn't last long, and they didn't really save any historical value at all. This king was not killed because he was a bad king. This king was killed because he was a great king. The part of the story that always gives me chills, though, is the ending. Since we found the mummy, Dr. Scott died in a car accident. Dr. Murphy died of undiagnosed pneumonia. Dr. Amy died of a helicopter crash. And Dr. Rick died of a scuba diving accident. I know I said I'm not one to really believe in curses, but I have a fear that this one may be true.